The EarthX 2024 Environmental and Sustainability Congress of Conferences is happening in Dallas, April 22nd through the 26th, bringing together all sides with one important mission: protect our planet. For info, earthx.org.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the forecast for the coming summer is record-breaking heat. It could be a deadly weather disaster that will challenge emergency services and put Texans at risk. And why a Texas plastic company is failing to accurately monitor its toxic discharge into the Gulf.
It's a waste of money. They can do it cheaper, they can do it more accurate, and they can do it more efficient. And PCEQ needs to update their studies.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. There is a high probability that the summer of 2024 will be another record breaker for heat and drought. That's according to the United Nations Weather Agency report released this week. The World Meteorological Organization is sounding a red alert about global warming. The buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is raising land and water temperatures and melting the glaciers and sea ice. Efforts to reverse the trend so far have been inadequate. Last summer in Texas was already a deadly record breaker. Over 300 people died from the heat in Texas in 2023, the most ever. This includes a 66-year-old postal worker delivering the mail in Dallas. So what do we do? It's getting hotter. Heat waves are lasting longer and are more frequent. And the state government officially denies that climate change is a thing. We've already seen recently the largest wildfire in the state's history. Expect more wildfires. And a new report out this week highlights the health impacts of extreme heat and the disproportionate risk to certain population groups. Trust for America's Health is calling for more robust emergency preparedness for the heat. I spoke to Rhea Faberman with Trust for America's Health.
We're having more heat events. They are of longer duration and they're more intense. So we really need to pay attention to heat, heat waves, and heat's impact on health. And that impact can be quite serious. Heat stroke is a serious issue. Heat can also exacerbate the effect of chronic disease, for example. And there are certain populations who are at higher risk during a heat event, older adults, people who are unhoused, people who work outdoors, young children, pregnant women. So every jurisdiction should have a heat plan, and that heat plan should pay particular attention to those higher risk population groups.
How is now more alarming, more difficult, more dangerous than it has been in the past?
Well, one data point that I think says it all is that in 2022, there were more weather-related deaths due to heat than any other type of weather event. So heat is happening. It's increasing in its intensity and its duration. It's also happening in parts of the country that are the so-called cooler parts of the country. Now, that Texas is not one of those states, but certainly even in a state like Texas, where you're somewhat used to the heat, the duration of heat waves is increasing and the temperature is just getting higher and higher.
Well, Texas is cooler, but in the attitude kind of way, not actually in the temperature kind of way.
Agreed.
How are we able to tell that more people are dying from heat-related issues when heat is not really something that's indicated on death certificates?
Well, the federal government tracks these issues, and public health data surveillance and tracking is an important part of what public health does to look at what is the impact of particular events and to be able to plan for events. So, the medical community is reports on deaths, and then federal statisticians and so forth look at those data and make determinations. What we do know is that there are more heat events, and clearly the climate is warmer. And that's leading to more heat events like the wildfires that you all experienced over the last month or so.
So with the heat comes more possibility, more vulnerability to these wildfires?
Yeah, I mean, a hotter environment is a drier environment, dry grasses and so forth, and that is more susceptible to wildfires and to wildfires that can quickly get out of control.
The extreme heat and the impact it has on people does have a cost on the economy. They're asking people who work outside to work earlier and take a break during the heat of the day. And is that something that's being recommended?
Well, what we recommend is that every city and county and state has a heat plan, and employers should also have a heat plan. And I think that plan is going to be different for different areas and different types of employment. The bottom line, though, is that people need to recognize that heat is a serious issue. It does impact health. So they need to be plans in place that are going to mitigate the potential health impacts of the heat. And it's up to the individual jurisdiction or individual employer how best to do that.
But in Texas, we have a law that prohibits municipalities to require that people who work outside be given water breaks. That seems like as heat becomes a more dangerous element, that's probably not good policy.
Well, when you look at heat plans from across the nation, and many cities and jurisdictions have heat plans in place now, the provision of water is certainly typically part of that plan.
So we're being asked to adapt to the heat and in our working outside. I see people who are working outside wearing broad brimmed hats that may be almost fluorescent colored because that might reflect heat, or using different techniques to keep cool. Is there a clearinghouse for what's the best way to deal with this type of stuff? Or is everyone kind of doing it on their own and cooking up ideas?
No, there's a number of good resources, many available on the web from federal agencies and from other organizations. Heat.gov is a very good resource. So there's no need for a jurisdiction or an employer to start from scratch or reinvent the wheel. There are some model heat plans and tracking databases to help people anticipate heat waves. So there are some important resources that are available both from organizations and from the federal government.
And then there are people who don't have access to air conditioning or even fans, live in public housing, the urban heat islands can impact different people differently, even in a small localized community.
Absolutely. One thing that we find is that, first of all, some people don't have air conditioning at all, but there's a phenomenon of people having air conditioning, but not being able to afford to use it. And that's very often the case for some older adults. So making sure that people have the wherewithal to use air conditioning if they have it. You mentioned urban heat islands. Those are communities where there's little shade and tree canopy to create shade. And there's a lot of asphalt, which increases temperature. So that's a phenomenon we need to think about. And we need to think about the built environment, like building shade, planting trees, different types of road materials that give off less heat. So these are all issues that should be part of the heat plan that every jurisdiction should have.
Should a city like San Antonio or other cities in South Texas or that are really dealing with the high heat, should they have a chief heat officer, someone who is dedicated to trying to help the population adapt to these things?
Yeah, it's a good idea to have a chief health officer, someone whose full-time job is to help the city or the county or the state plan for and respond to heat events. I believe there are 11 chief heat officers in the country now. And it's a very good idea to have one. Just like you want to have someone who is in charge of emergency response, you want to have someone who's in charge of heat response as well.
I'm trying to cover this story as much as I can. And last summer, went out as they worked with the people who were unhoused, and they were giving them of ice and all sorts of things to help them cool down. But what are some stories that I could be looking for?
Well, you mentioned unhoused people. That's obviously, you know, if you don't have access to a roof over your head, you don't have access to air conditioning, you don't have access to shade. So that's an issue. It's also people who live in poorly maintained housing, be that public housing or privately owned housing. If your house lacks insulation, if your house is in disrepair, it's often difficult to keep cool. At many school systems, I don't know the numbers for Texas, but there are school systems in across the country that don't have strong ventilation, good ventilation systems, and or air conditioning. That's obviously a problem during the warm months. So there's so many issues around these, around heat that need intervention as the climate warms and more people are at risk because of that warming.
How does heat figure into the broad look at these threats to public health?
Yeah, well, we mentioned wildfires, and a hot environment is a drier environment, which can lead to wildfires. So that's part of it. Heat waves and just a warmer climate can also increase the insect population. And some insects carry disease. You know, you might get a mosquito bite that could lead to disease. So that's an increased risk as well. Water can sometimes be affected. Water supply can be affected by intense heat. So there are many ramifications and multiplier effects from the warming climate.
Are we doing enough to prepare? Because it's just going to get hotter.
Right. And I would say the answer is no, we're not doing enough to prepare. And that's across a spectrum of potential emergencies, heat being one of a spectrum. We really need to invest more consistently and in a sustained way in public health infrastructure, and mitigating and responding to heat would be part of that.
Rhea Faberman is with Trust for America's Health. Their new report is called Ready or Not 2024, Protecting the Public's Health from Disease, Disasters, and Bioterrorism. We have a link to the full report on our website at tpr.org. Now let's take a break.
The EarthX 2024 Environmental and Sustainability Congress of Conferences is happening in Dallas, April 22nd through the 26th, bringing together all sides with one important mission: protect our planet. For info, earthx.org.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A new report by the Environmental Integrity Project compiled data on every U.S. plastics plant built, expanded, or proposed since 2012, revealing a massive growth in Texas. Many of these plants take public subsidies, like tax breaks, yet many of them break environmental laws. That's according to the report, Feeding the Plastics Industrial Complex. This growth is a direct result of the fracking boom in Texas. Pipelines carry oil and natural gas to the coast, where the refineries and chemical plants turn them into commercial products like plastics. These chemical plants demand a lot of fresh water, and they also produce a lot of chemical waste that's dumped into the bays of the Texas Gulf Coast, like the Lavaca, Matagorda, and Corpus Christi bays. Research shows that there is a long-term decline of ecosystem health in Lavaca Bay, and a coalition of more than 65 groups are calling on Texas to change how Formosa is allowed to monitor its own toxic discharge. I spoke to Diane Wilson, executive director of San Antonio Bay Estuary Waterkeeper. In December 2019, Wilson won a landmark case against Formosa Plastics for the illegal dumping of toxic plastic waste into Lavaca Bay.
I'm a fourth generation fisherwoman, and my family's lived in this area like 130 years, and I've been fighting the chemical plants around here, specifically mostly Formosa, for 35 years. So that's pretty much how you can introduce me.
What is happening right now? What is the concern with the Formosa plant?
There's a lot of different issues. You know, we did a lawsuit in 2019. It was a citizen clean water suit, and it was for all their plastic violations into Lavaca, Matagorda Bay, and Cox's Creek. And so we sued them, And we actually won the case, and it was the settlement was the largest citizen suit settlement in U.S. history. It was $50 billion. And we got zero discharge from them, zero discharge of plastics. We got cleanup. We got monitoring. We got retrofitting the units to get to zero discharge. But the thing that we sent you, the letter, is when, you know, Formosa has been in Calhoun County since 1983. They were a little plant in 1983. And in 1989, Formosa Plastics, which is from Taiwan, it's a family dynasty, it's a family owned, they had the biggest plastic expansion in Texas history. At that time, it was like probably around $2 billion, and it was the largest in the United States in 10 years. So it was this huge expansion, and because there was real concern that Formosa had a reputation, especially in Taiwan, of being a real polluter, when Formosa got its permit from the state of Texas, probably around 1990, 1991, they made Formosa do a, what they call a receiving waters monitoring program. And that was to make sure that Formosa's discharge did not damage Matagorda Bay and Lavaca Bay. So there was this study. Formosa kind of designed it, made the monitoring, the standards operating procedure. It was okayed by the state of Texas. So for 30 years, there has been this very in-depth monitoring of the bay to make sure Formosa doesn't harm the bay. And Formosa touts this study and said, this proves we have not done any harm to the bay. But the only thing is, the way they monitor the levels at which they test the chemicals are so high, you never reach it. So they're all non-detect. So everything is, all the chemicals are like 99.99% non-detect.
They're testing things at a very high level, and we're talking about chemicals that are highly toxic. So in a sense, this is
absolutely. And the thing is, they do it though. They do a lot of them. Matter of fact, they even boast about how many samples that they have taken, which is around 500,000. But it's like, why are you doing all of these when really we need some very specific ones? We need to be testing the sediment, and you need to lower them so you can see at what level that these chemicals can create harm in the bay. And they're at these really high levels. So it's like it shows nothing. You look on their website, and it is on their website, and it talks about this Lavaca Bay monitoring program and how it proves that they have not harmed the bay. I just happened to find out about it when Hart Institute for Gulf of Mexico Studies down in Corpus Christi. They're very good scientists and biologists and all this, and they have been studying the bays for 30 years, all of the Texas bays, and they said this bay, Matagorda Bay, has got a real problem that the rest of them don't have. And what he talks about is this, he calls it the benthic community, and it's the stuff at the bottom of the bay. And it's where, when you have a nursery area, this is where all your marine species survive when they're little. This is extremely important, but it's disappearing. The mass and the diversity of this benthic community is going down, and they were alarmed about it. And so they did a study of this 30-year study that had been ongoing by Formosa, and that's pretty much what they found out. Yeah, we're asking TCEQ to update it, make it at the very least what they got to go by NOAA, a National Oceanic Administration, at least at their standards, because it's you know, matter of fact, I talked to one of the scientists at Heart Research, and I was talking about the study, and he said it's a waste of money. They can do it cheaper, they can do it more accurate, and they can do it more efficient. And TCEQ needs to update this study so we really can see what is going on with Matagorda Bay.
The TCEQ needs to tell Formosa to tell its contractor to raise its standards to be more sensitive in detecting these toxic chemicals that are possibly being put into the bay, right?
Yeah. Actually, what we're telling TCEQ to do is to talk with the scientists at Heart Institute and talk to them about how that study needs to be improved, and then make sure Formosa does that.
All right. So what's happening right now with the Lavaca, Matagorda Bay, Formosa, there is right now this big rush of the plastic industry developing plants up and down the Texas coast because of all of the petroleum fracking that we have in Texas. They have cheap and easy access to natural gas and petroleum to in order to produce their plastics. This is a downstream effect of extra stress and pollutants going into the bays up and down the Texas coast. So what's happening with Formosa in your area is not a local issue. This is happening all up and down the Texas coast.
It is happening. There's places up further. Matter of fact, I'm in Corpus Christi right now. And right here in Corpus Christi, Ingleside, Portland, they've got all these plastic plants. You know, they've got them up around Port Arthur, up around there. They're trying all over the place. Formosa is trying to expand. They got Louisiana. They're trying to expand in Louisiana. It's not only the damage that we're finding out what's going on in the bays and taking the water. So you're increasing the salinity in the bay and you're removing the fresh water. It's, you know, now they're finding out all of these health impacts of plastic.
So do you think the TCEQ, which is not known for its response to concerns from environmentalists, are they going to pay attention to this request to increase these monitoring levels? Or is this just not just business as usual will continue?
Well, it was interesting. I sent the letter out to all the commissioners and the executive director yesterday morning, and then yesterday about 4 o'clock, I got an email from the executive director of TCEQ, Kelly Kell, and she wrote me that she got the letter, and they are looking at our request, whatever that means. So we'll see. And we've had about 65 groups, national, statewide groups, local groups that have signed on, and we are not going to let this go. They have to change. They're going to have to do it. We'll see if it's going to be more than that.
Okay,
but it's. You know, we won't want to wait long. We're not going to wait long.
Will you file suit?
We will figure out something. Trust me. We will figure out something.
Diane Wilson is the executive director of San Antonio Bay Estuary Waterkeeper. Harris County is paying millions of dollars to private prison companies to send hundreds of inmates out of state to reduce overcrowding in the county jail. However, as Houston Public Media's Lucio Vasquez reports, Harris County may not be able to protect those from being held in private facilities with seemingly little oversight.
35-year-old Billy Davis was booked into the Harris County Jail on Valentine's Day 2 years ago for evading arrest. About 2 weeks later, he was found unresponsive in a cell at a private prison in Louisiana, nearly 300 miles from home. Less than an hour later, he was dead. A coroner's report says he suffered from multiple blunt force injuries during a fight. His death was ultimately ruled a homicide. Davis was transferred to the LaSalle Correctional Center, a privately owned out-of-state prison receiving millions of dollars from Harris County to house up to 500 people. The county is also contracted with a company called Core Civic to house even more people at a prison in Tallahatchie County, Mississippi. Even though the move is to relieve overcrowding and understaffing at the Harris County Jail, there's still uncertainty about what kind of accountability, if any, can be found at these private prisons outside of Texas. Philip Bosquez, an assistant chief with the sheriff's office, couldn't give a specific answer when asked about the standards at the Tallahatchie facility during a meeting with state officials last month.
So do you have any idea what the standards are in Mississippi as compared to Texas? As far as just ratios or rounds?
No, not as well versed as I am with the jail commission regulations. They have some standards.
The county's $16 million contract with LaSalle says their prison must comply with Louisiana's best practices, even though it's not overseen by the state. The $11 million contract with Core Civic says the Tallahatchie facility must comply with standards from the American Correctional Association, or the ACA. But a 2020 congressional investigation accused the organization of being riddled with conflicts of interest, that it was impossible to fail an inspection. It found the ACA gives private facilities a 3-month notice before inspections, and that even if problems are found, the ACA can still allow these prisons to pass.
So as a practical matter, when a public agency puts prisoners in a private facility, they're essentially surrendering control over how they're treated.
That was David Fati, director of the ACLU National Prison Project. He says the ACA's accreditation is essentially meaningless. Plus, the congressional investigation found that nearly half of the ACA's revenue comes from private prison companies.
The ACA has a strong financial incentive not to be too demanding in the accreditation process.
Over the last few years, both Core Civic and LaSalle have been accused of falsifying records, improperly reporting inmate deaths, and mishandling sexual abuse claims. The Harris County Sheriff's Office says they're in regular contact with the private prisons and would consider canceling the contracts if standards aren't met. Yet, Fati says Harris County's contracts with both companies lack teeth.
The agency isn't really able to meaningfully enforce whatever standards the private prison may have agreed to in the contract.
Even at the state level, officials have little authority over how Texas detainees are treated when they aren't housed in Texas. Brandon Wood, the executive director of the Texas Commission on Jail Standards, says even though he's unfamiliar with the ACA standards,
I do not believe that an outside set of standards would be better than the ones that we've currently developed.
With a growing death toll within the Harris County Jail, the county seems committed to using private prisons for the foreseeable future. And as they continue to export people to out-of-state prisons, it remains unclear whether they're safer in Harris County's overcrowded jail or a private prison hundreds of miles away. I'm Lucio Vasquez in Houston.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org. You can download and subscribe to us wherever you find cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.